I declare the meeting open at 5:30 p.m. I welcome councillors, management, and members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge that we are meeting on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. This place is now known by the name of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the great multicultural cities of the world and a significant meeting place. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place and a location for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public that the meeting is being recorded and will be made available on the City of Melbourne website before close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of the meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should you have any queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation and submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting. I request that all mobile phones be turned to silent for the duration of the meeting. The agenda comprises 8 reports from management, one of which is confidential, and 3 items of general business, and no apologies have been received. I'd like to begin, before we get into the formal meeting, with a condolence statement for Ron Walker AC. Ron Walker, we sadly at the City of Melbourne acknowledge the passing of former Lord Mayor Ron Walker on the 30th of January 2018. Ron was first elected to the City of Melbourne on 22nd of August 1968 to the Hoddle Ward, and after 10 years of service resigned on the 14th of August 1978, having served as Lord Mayor from the 26th of August 1974 to the 29th of August 1976. At the age of 34, Ron was one of the youngest to be elected as Lord Mayor of the City of Melbourne. Ron was committed to reinvigorating the city at a time when development had stalled, remarking that a plan will achieve little if it does not lead to action. He was an instrumental part of the city's revival at the time, which led to the extension of pedestrian access and open space in Bourke Street and the creation of the Bourke Street Mall. Ron also influenced the development of City Square into a vibrant open space for the community. Following his time as Lord Mayor, he continued to follow his passion for Melbourne by filling the city's calendar with major events, race meetings, international motor races, cultural festivals, and conventions, all of which have shaped the city's reputation as the events capital of Australia. In 1981, Ron and his wife Barbara donated to the people of Victoria the iconic jet water fountain located on the corner of Linlithgow Avenue and St Kilda Road. Its vibrant lighting design is often used to celebrate public events. The City of Melbourne extends its deepest sympathies to Ron's wife Barbara, family and friends, and we note that a state funeral will be held for Ron Walker tomorrow. I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge former Councillor Tessa Sullivan, who resigned as a Councillor in December 2017. I thank Tessa for her contribution to Council during her term of office, and on behalf of myself and my fellow Councillors, the Chief Executive Officer and the Administration of the City of Melbourne, we wish her well for the future. I'd also like to take this opportunity to welcome our new Councillor, Beverly Pinder-Mortimer, to Council. I'll use new in inverted commas. Councillor Pinder-Mortimer was declared elected following a recount conducted by the Victorian Electoral Commission on the 15th of January 2018. Councillor Pinder-Mortimer took the oath of office and declared she had read and will abide by the Councillor Code of Conduct before the Chief Executive Officer at a private ceremony on 17th of January 2018. In accordance with the provisions of the Local Government Act 1989, I ask that this be noted in the minutes of this meeting. Councillor Beverly Pinder-Mortimer is a returning councillor and, having served on the previous council from October 2012 to October 2016, will be well known to many of you. We congratulate you on your re-election and wish you a successful and rewarding term in office. I take this opportunity to also acknowledge former Lord Mayor Robert Doyle AC, who formally resigned yesterday. Robert Doyle was City of Melbourne's longest serving Lord Mayor and was first elected to Melbourne City Council in November 2008. In November 2016, Robert Doyle was re-elected as Lord Mayor for an historic third term. Robert Doyle has made a significant contribution to the City of Melbourne and will leave an indelible mark on our city. He was deeply passionate about creating a vibrant, sustainable and forward-looking city that richly deserves its mantle as the world's most livable city. I ask the Council to move a motion that the Future Melbourne Committee resolves to allow the filming, photography, recording of various segments of this evening's meeting in accordance with the request made by various media outlets. Moved by Councillor Leppard, seconded by Councillor Nick Francis-Gilley. All those in favour? I declare that carried unanimously. If any councillor has either a direct or indirect conflict as interest as defined in Local Government Act 1989, in relation to a matter to be considered by a committee, please disclose the type and nature of your interest prior to consideration of this item. I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of open meeting number 26. Councillor Rees and seconded by Councillor Riley. And all those in favour? Councillor Francis Gilley? I declare that carried unanimously. I ask councillors, were there any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meeting? No? The following submissions and correspondence have been received in accordance with the Council's Meeting Procedures Code. In relation to Agenda Item 6.1, West Melbourne Structure Plan 2018, items of correspondence from Matthew Williams. In relation to Agenda Item 6.2, the Ministerial Referral for 731 739 Flinders Street, Docklands. Requests to speak from Chris Johnson, FK Australia, Jamie Govanlock from Urbis, and Neil Edwards, and items of correspondence from Neil Edwards. In relation to Agenda Item 6.6, the Victorian Government Assessment of the Westgate Tunnel Project Environmental Effects. Request to speak from Bernard and Robin, Jerry McLaughlin, and items of correspondence from Rosa McKenna, Bernard Robin and Jerry McLaughlin. In relation to Agenda Item 6.6A, the update on the status of the investigation into allegations regarding the Lord Mayor Robert Doyle AC and related matters. Request to speak from Councillor Cole Ross, National President of the Australian Local Government Women's Association. Items of correspondence from Ray Cowling, from Coral Ross, and also from Rebecca McKenzie from LG Pro. In relation to Agenda Item 7.1, the post-travel report by Councillor Rohan Leppert, Hamburg, Brussels and Barcelona, October 2017, an item of correspondence from Chris Thrum. In relation to Agenda Item 7.2, notice of motion from Councillor Leppert on the Apple Store at Federation Square. We've got requests to speak from Chris Thrum, Narelle Launt, Emily Keating, Corey Corbett, Tanya Davidage, Adrian Jackson. Items of correspondence from Ros McCormick, Rohan Story, Chris Thrum, Simon Ambrose, Mike Nekraskov, Carrie Landwehr, Kate Shannon, Christoph Mallett, Rebecca Leslie, Kate Brooks, Nikki Cooper, Sarah Harvey, Joyce Caracas, Narelle Launt, Chris Ziziadis, Emily Keating, Brian Kavanagh, Amanda Zivizic, Ben Van Aker, Corey Corbett, Justin Zabo, Paul Boulins, Andrew Ranieri, Terry Chadwick, Tanya Davidich, T. Verns, Ewound Bunt, Kevin Meese, Charmaine Gord, and Jeanette Graham. And I also note over 140 written submissions have been received via the Do Gooder platform in relation to this agenda item. 840. Sorry, I should say. I advise submitters that you'll be invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. You'll have 3 minutes to address the committee. It's the intention of the committee to adhere to this three-minute time limit and to assist you. A bell will ring at the completion of 2 minutes, signalling that you have 1 minute remaining to conclude your address. A bell will ring again to signal the time allocated to you has finished. I'd also like to remind members of the public that they shouldn't make comments which may be considered to be objectionable, offensive, defamatory or inappropriate. In accordance with the Council's Meetings Procedure Code, a 15-minute period will be provided at the beginning and end of the meeting for members of the public to ask questions. Questions should not be greater than 90 seconds in duration. A bell will ring to signal the time allocated to you has finished. And I remind members of the public that this is not the time to make submissions, it's the time to ask questions. Submitters will be invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. As you know from the management report included on tonight's agenda, the investigation into allegations against the former Lord Mayor has been delayed, and as such we won't be answering any questions in relation to the investigation itself. I now invite questions from the public. Just please raise your hand, and when you come to the lectern here, state your name and then ask a question. Do we have any questions from the public? Yep, just up the back, come to the lectern and just state your name and ask your question.
Okay, thank you so much. My name's Alfredo Malabello, and I've been in Melbourne now for just about 14 months. I moved over here from Sydney to open up a cocktail bar in Lygon Street called the Vodka Temple, and it's a piano bar, probably the only piano bar in Melbourne. There was lots and lots of them in the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. They all died off because it was not cool enough. But now I've worked all over the world and I've come to Melbourne to do what I do. Now, 12 months ago, I came here to this chamber, and I had the was generously given 10 minutes of the Lord Mayor's time to discuss my issues with Lygon Street. Lygon Street is suffering a massive depression, especially from Grafton Street to Queensbury Street. Now, 12 months ago, I asked the Lord Mayor and also Chez Ash and Ian Dryden to help with the issue. And to their credit, they did everything that I guess they should do, but nothing has been achieved. Nothing has been achieved. And we have had 4 restaurants go broke between Grafton Street and Queensbury Street. We've got another 2 empty. We're dying. I suggested let's get fairy lights and turn that section of Lygon Street into something like a Parisian thing, you know, Rue de Lygon sort of thing, to dress it up.
Your question is that about...
The question is, we're dying. I tried. My questions are not getting answered. My phone calls are not getting returned. The emails are not getting responded to. We are dying. Can you please help?
I'm happy to... this is the first I've heard of the issue. I'm happy to follow up on that issue to check the correspondence that's been received and work with my fellow councillors.
What should I do those. Now? Because there's nothing else I need to say,
I'm happy if you see council business over here and just inform them again of your name. I didn't quite catch it in full, and we'll follow up on your correspondence.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Just here, thank you. Just your name and your question, thanks.
Thank you. My name's Janine Marnie. For decades I've worked with people who've experienced family violence, sexual assault and bullying. I've been disappointed, obviously, over the last recent months to see what's been occurring within the city of Melbourne. As an employer, the council has an obligation to create a safe workplace and to make sure that it protects all who come into that workplace, the staff, the councillors and the members of the public. There is a duty of care that is an obligation of this organisation. I'm just wondering, what will the council now do to step up, to become the leaders, to set a benchmark in best practice, rather than to have brought this dreadful scenario that now people within this room itself have had to speak out as survivors because there was no policy? What is the council going to do to step up and make Melbourne proud of it?
Thanks for your question, part of the response, and I won't refer to the actual item at hand, which is still the subject of the investigation, but you will see on the agenda tonight that we will consider a management report for any other sort of gaps or issues that have been identified that can keep on improving what are actually excellent processes in the organisation. Of course, we can always do better, and that's exactly what we're going to set out to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks very much, everyone. In accordance with the council resolution of the 31st of October 2002, does any council wish to discuss the confidential status of confidential agenda item 6.7? No. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than 6 members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. So our first order of business, I move that the Future Melbourne Committee change the order of business to allow consideration of agenda item 6.6A prior to the consideration of the other reports from management. I call on the councillor. Thank you, Councillor Leppett, and I put that to the vote. All those councillors in favour, and I declare that carried. So we address item 6.6A first with that change of order of business. There is one report from management for consideration under the finance and governance portfolio. That is agenda item 6.6A, the update on the status of the investigation into allegations regarding the Lord Mayor, Robert Doyle, AC, and related matters. And I call on Ben Rimmer, the CEO, to make a brief presentation.
Thank you very much, Acting Lord Mayor. I'd like to make brief comments in relation to 3 aspects of our current situation. Firstly, the current status of the investigation. As the committee is aware, the investigation has been underway since late December. the interim draft report of the investigation by Dr. Ian Freckleton QC was provided to the former Lord Mayor on the 30th of January. Dr. Freckleton has been asked to advise on the facts of this situation. He has not been asked to advise on the legal conclusions to be drawn from those facts or on the broader policy issues that have surfaced. For clarity, there are five people on the investigation team who have seen the draft report, including three Minter Ellison lawyers, junior counsel, and Dr. Freckleton QC. Outside of these five people, only one copy of the report exists. That copy was hand-delivered to the former Lord Mayor's legal representatives last Tuesday, following assurances given by the former Lord Mayor and his lawyers that it would be held confidential. No other individual, including myself, has a copy of the draft interim report. As is publicly known, the former Lord Mayor's lawyers told us on Friday, the 2nd of February, that the former Lord Mayor was seriously ill. The former Lord Mayor then resigned yesterday, on Monday, the 5th of February. The resignation of the former Lord Mayor does not change the investigation process or timeline. It's still necessary in managing the health and safety of this workplace to bring the investigation to conclusion and to establish the facts. Of course, the options that are available to me as Chief Executive Officer in responding to the investigation have changed as a result of the resignation. For procedural reasons that I cannot divulge, there has been no further progress in finalising the interim report at this stage. My objective is to see Dr. Freckleton's investigation finalised as soon as is possible, consistent with procedural fairness and in the interest of all parties. The integrity of the investigation, which has the sole aim of establishing the facts, has always been the key objective. However, as is obvious, I cannot control the behaviour of any of the parties or of the media. That is why I've been so strident, perhaps annoyingly strident, in advising councillors and former councillors that their best course of action is not to comment on the investigation, and in particular the detail of any allegations or their implications. I've also urged media outlets to consider that the public interest is best served by allowing the current investigation and reporting processes to conclude unhindered and without the publication of inflammatory, damaging or speculative information or commentary. I'm acutely aware of the interests of the complainants in this matter and their evident distress and their desire to see the investigation concluded. I'm also acutely aware of Council's interest in resolving this matter, the benefits to the Melbourne community in general of rapid resolution, and the broader public interest in this matter. My aim is to publicly release the outcomes of the investigation as soon as possible. For legal reasons, I cannot comment further on the process involved in the investigation or the choices the investigation team has made during the course of the investigation. Of course, I cannot comment on the draft findings of Dr. Freckleton because I do not know what they are. And in any case, they are draft findings that have not yet been finalised. Because I cannot comment on the findings, I also cannot comment on what decisions I would have made about necessary action I should take in response to those findings. In other words, to put it plainly, there are many issues that are subject of current media and community debate that I and the City of Melbourne more generally cannot comment on at this time, given the sensitive stage that the investigation process has reached, and in particular to protect the rights and interests of all parties. While I cannot comment further on the status of the investigation, I can explain something of the reasoning that led to its establishment. On Friday, 15 December, I was advised of serious allegations against the former Lord Mayor by former Councillor Tessa Sullivan in a meeting at my office in Town Hall. I was extremely concerned from the commencement of the meeting for Ms. Sullivan and was aware of the courage she had taken to approach me and the Manager of Governance and Legal with this information. Creating an environment where complainants feel safe to speak up is very important to me and to this organisation. I was very conscious of ensuring the complainants were comfortable with the steps I was about to take. I tried very hard, as did Mr. Williamson, to dissuade Ms. Sullivan from resigning as a councillor. The allegations at that stage were a collection of material that was not sworn as a statutory declaration nor signed. Nevertheless, the allegations raised urgent and substantial concerns about the safety of the City of Melbourne workplace for a number of councillors. Under local government and occupational health and safety legislation, I am accountable for maintaining a safe workplace for councillors, council staff and contractors, and the members of the public who use our services. My first task was to immediately establish the facts and seek advice on what I should do. Chief Executive officers are public servants who are accountable to council and through councils to the community. It is right and proper that a CEO does not have the power to control or manage councillor behaviour or actions. It flows from this that it would have been better if there was a legislative process that could manage the circumstances that I was in. However, it is important when allegations of this nature arise that there are clear, effective and timely avenues for effective management in the interests of all parties, and I had the accountability to maintain a safe workplace. Therefore, I immediately engaged well-respected legal representation and then agreed to establish an arm's-length independent investigation by Dr. Ian Freckleton, QC. I informed the former Lord Mayor of these matters and my immediate actions within 48 hours of receiving them. The investigation team then confirmed the allegations with the complainants and established which lines of inquiry were to be pursued. The investigation process then commenced in earnest. Importantly, it was undertaken from a presumption of innocence. From the investigation's first minute, it was instructed to accord natural justice and procedural fairness to all parties, and particularly to the former Lord Mayor. I believe it has achieved that objective at this time. We had an urgent and immediate OH&S issue. It was clear to me that we had to resolve this situation as quickly as possible. The former Lord Mayor agreed to take leave while the investigation was underway. I'm confident in saying that we've worked our way through the situation we faced effectively. However, any significant challenge, any crisis that confronts existing legislation, policies and processes offers an opportunity to reflect and improve Council's capability to respond. All good organisations look for opportunities to improve. While some of the processes and policies have been challenging, as we have outlined in the management report, I'm confident that we can use this situation to improve. That will require Council to consider updating its code of conduct. It will require the organisation to make changes to some of its current policies. And it may require the state government to consider sector-wide issues that could come out of our experience and that may be relevant in the review of the Local Government Act and other legislation. I commend the report to the committee.
Thank you, CEO. I now call on Councillor Coral Ross, who requests the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Thanks, Councillor.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor and Councillors. I thank you for the opportunity to make this submission. I speak to you as the National President of the Australian Local Government Women's Association. My submission relates purely with your Councillor Code of Conduct. As the management report states, which is before you, Councils can review and amend your Councillor Code of Conduct at any time, and the Councillor Code of Conduct can also cover items which are not specified in the Local Government Act. So my questions to you as Council are, will the City of Melbourne Councillors review its current Code of Conduct so that, firstly, complaints by councillors against the Lord Mayor or Deputy Lord Mayor would go to an independent person rather than the Lord Mayor or Deputy Lord Mayor? Secondly, following any internal review, would it be that an independent person rather than the councillors should decide upon any possible sanctions? And lastly, will you add a clause to the Melbourne City Councillor's Code of Conduct specifically relating to harassment, both physical and sexual? Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Ross. Any questions for Councillor Ross? No, you can answer when you speak to the item, though. Absolutely. Thanks, Councillor Ross. So I'm happy to move the motion that's on screen here. I'll just allow everyone to read that. There's a slight change from management at 13.2, and I'll speak to each of those items. We'll give you a quick chance to have a look at those, and I'll call for a seconder. And the seconder is Councillor Francis Gillie. And I now call on Councillor Oak to speak. I'll reserve my right to speak, I should say, and I'm assuming Councillor Francis Gillie will do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Okay, keep it together. As the CEO has just said, tonight we're considering a status update and the CEO's initial views on the current investigation before it has concluded and before any findings have been made public. Given the investigation hasn't concluded, and I'm conscious to keep my remarks to the report we're being asked to consider on tonight's agenda, whilst noting my deep frustration that without a conclusion, I continue to feel disempowered to speak, nor have the ability to speak up for a colleague who is very brave. But I do remain very supportive of the investigation as detailed by the CEO. I'm also acutely aware of the considerable mental and physical stress that key people are experiencing. So whilst frustrated, I understand why there's been a delay in receiving the report. I also understand why at this first committee meeting of council for the year, there is a need to include an update, as we've just heard, and we see on the report from management in lieu of the final report. We also see, though, of course, that we've got a lot of other agenda items, and that and whilst we as councillors haven't met formally since last December, council has been getting on with what it does best, looking after our great city. Council officers and my colleagues have been getting on with it, and tonight's agenda shows you that. Okay, so on to the report from management. I start by saying, this is a tough part, the boring part comes later. Sorry. I start by saying that any form of sexual harassment within or outside of the workplace should be reported and acted upon. Victims certainly should not see that the only option before them is to resign to seek justice. I encourage anyone, especially women, who have experienced unacceptable behaviour towards them to report it. However, it's not easy to act immediately if you're personally involved. And I would never pressure another woman to tell their story, nor how they should tell their story. That was the tough part. All of this is, of course, compounded when workplace norms do not encourage speaking out, or the avenues to speak out are flawed. Avenues to act are determined by the law, by workplace structures, and policies, and by legal support systems. The role of a counsellor is challenging because we are both part of an organisational structure and also accountable to the electorate that is not part of the organisational structure. Management has identified a necessary improvement to our code of conduct, and I obviously support a review. Given the construction of the Local Government Act and the potential for the council's code of conduct to guide a councillor to a particular conclusion about what their options are, despite the fact that the full suite of options available to them may be broader than that, It is clearly very difficult for a councillor to know how to formally address sexual harassment towards them. It is certainly difficult to navigate the statutory processes without advice of a confidant or a lawyer, and this doesn't come without significant financial sacrifice, I can tell you. So I support a review of our code of conduct and to make these processes more accessible, and I support the other recommendations in the report on how to address gaps in our policies. But while I welcome management's work, until we have the report into the current investigation and a full and frank conversation from councillors, I believe is premature. Management's reports can make recommendations to improve our protocols and processes, but our job and the way that we got here is adversarial in nature, and power dynamics aren't only defined by the law. So we as the council need to acknowledge that and ensure that every one of us is contributing to a culture that allows both councillors to do the job that we've been elected to do while ensuring that there's no fear of speaking out about inappropriate behaviour. And this isn't about politics, this is about people. We know that women in all levels of government have experienced inappropriate behaviour towards men in their workplace. What I hope we can do is to use the report to make a change for ourselves and our colleagues at the local government level that enables our workplace culture to support healthy political operations and human interactions. I strongly believe that the solution isn't just what is written in our councillor protocols. There's a responsibility on all of us to recognise where power lies and to foster a healthy workplace for everyone, aligned with the values that we all hold as important and that our community would expect. I conclude by saying that I'm supportive of the investigation process, which is clear, and I reiterate that I won't be making any further comments until it's concluded. I, of course, say a very big thank you to my family and my friends and the community for their ongoing support. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor. I know that was very difficult, so thank you very much for your bravery. Probably changing tack and a little bit more boring than that, just to go to the motion itself and talk through that motion. So item 13.1 notes the status of Dr. Ian Freckleton QC's investigation into the allegations that is still continuing. As Councillor Oak rightly noted, that discussion about any outcomes from the investigation is premature at this stage, and that's why we're rightly focused on the management report into things that we can do, gaps that have been identified throughout this process that we can actually take early action on. 13.2 notes that the Chief Executive Officer has advised that to date no concerns about the conduct of any persons other than the Lord Mayor have been identified as requiring investigation. 13.3 notes that management has commenced productive discussions with the appropriate Victorian Government Department and the Victorian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commissioner about matters identified in the framework and under the Local Government Act, and not just items relating to sexual harassment, but other items as well. This picks up on our first question, I think it was Janine, and also aspects identified by Councillor Coral Ross on where we can use, as Councillor Oak said, this report and this sort of interim step to actually bring about positive change, not just in our own organisation, but right across the sector. Item 13.4 notes that management is reviewing all corporate policies that refer to councillor conduct or purport to cover councillor conduct, and the policies are numerous. As Councillor Oak said, navigating all the different policies, and it's certainly incorrect to say that There isn't a raft of policies at organisational level, but navigating those policies and how they relate to each other, and indeed how councillors fit into that process, is very important. And 13.5, which as a group we're unified in accepting, is to agree to review our councillor code of conduct and improve that where deficiencies have been identified. So I commend management for their work on, I guess, getting the jump on things that we can do as an organisation, but also working much more widely to improve the sector as a whole. And as was noted, that this isn't just isolated to our organisation or just our sector. This is a generational change that's going on. I now call on Councillor Nick Francis Gilley to speak.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. throughout this process, I've spoken to lots of people, and it is clear that when events such as this happen, it's not only extraordinarily painful for the events themselves, but it's painful for those people around, the people that feel hurt and abused, and it also then brings up lots of situations for others. So I know that as a city, many people have found this really difficult and confronting, and as such, I think, and particularly when that hurt is there, and then every day this is being played out in public, and the story is being led on the front page of newspapers, it becomes extraordinarily frightening for the people that are in the middle of it. What will I see tomorrow? What might that mean tomorrow? What might this phone call mean? And that has been true for people in the organisation, people now outside of the organisation. So it's very easy when you see all of that to look at it and go, it should be better. And of course, when anyone's hurting, you can look at it and see it should be better. And I think, Coral, to your point, and I hope it came across clearly with the CEO's report, we are immediately moving to look at what processes we might change and we might look to improve immediately, so processes, even before we hear the particulars of this report. So we are not waiting to see if we can't make this play, learn from the experiences that we have done to make it safer for people and improve those policies. But I also want to say that as somebody who is new to politics and to council life, my experience of this was people grappling with those policies that didn't answer this circumstance at all, for those inside it and all those for those managing it. And I really want to acknowledge, I think, the extraordinary commitment to, as much as possible within those constraints, caring for as many people as is possible. And so I would I really acknowledge the management team and other councillors for that commitment to do that as the best as we possibly could. So I think, and Cathy, thank you for being so strong, and also for Tessa, for being willing to make a stand. It is clear that around the world, and also for us, that our behaviours, and particularly behaviours of men, have not been what the public should expect or what we should expect of ourselves. And regardless of the particulars of this case, we all, I think, have an opportunity to look at this and reflect on this and see how we personally may be behaving in a way that is part of creating an environment that is not as safe as we would like it. So with respect to this, I think the motion is doing two things. It is immediately moving to review all the processes that cover sexual harassment and care of victims, and to look at how we might improve them as soon as possible. With regard to particular circumstances of the events covered by the investigation, as the CEO stated, once we receive the report, its findings will be made public, and it may be... And it may be at this point there will be further action we should take. And when we get to that point, it will be an opportunity then to reflect and see if we did enough or if there are other things that have come to light that we should now act on. As inconvenient as and as painful as that delay is, as we've seen tonight, I think it's important that we take that time to ensure that there is justice, is considered for all, and that we are in the best position to make a decision about how we move forward. Thank you.
CEO, just a point of clarification on the report itself.
Councillor Francis Gilley, without wishing to be difficult, I can't at this stage commit to council that the findings will be made public. What I said in my opening is that that is my aim. And there are a whole range of legal processes currently underway. My aim, on behalf of council, throughout those legal processes, will be to have the outcomes of the process public.
Thanks, CEO. Any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Wright.
Thank you. I also was really disappointed to have had a crisis to realise there are flaws in our code of conduct. I acknowledge the failing of the current code to recognise sexual or physical harassment. However, councillors will work with management to improve on this. And I do agree with Councillor Ross just said that an independent reporting system rather than the Lord Mayor or the Deputy Lord Mayor would be worth pursuing, and that an independent person such as a minister rather than councillors decide on possible sanctions. And I think we could go forward with that.
Thanks, Councillor Riley. Any speakers? Councillor Leibold.
Look, this isn't pleasant, especially when it involves people who you are know or close to. In regards to Robert, you know, he has given me counsel and advice before and after I enter council, and it's one that I do appreciate. I guess in regards to Tessa, I really enjoyed working with, and it's quite saddening that two of the councillors that I'm probably the closest to, Michael Kaif and Tessa Sullivan, are, you know, they're gone. And, you know, I'll forever miss Tessa's vibrancy and her dedication to the many causes. And I still remember many times that we talk about what we want to achieve in the four years that we have here. I wish her well and her family in this difficult time, and I hope that this does not deter her from seeking public office in the future. I also want to acknowledge the braveness of the people who has come forward in this matter and hope they find peace in this difficult time, especially Kathy, who I can't imagine how hard it would be for her to hear. I also want to say how proud I am to work for City of Melbourne and also for the people of Melbourne. It's an honour and privilege to be walking around with this badge on. I think that is the most fundamental thing. It's sometimes easier to throw rocks at a glass house than to protect, and I say to the 1,600 staff on Team Melbourne that we will come out of this stronger and better, and I hope that you will put your faith in us to lead that. Finally, I'd like to also say that some of the things I would love to see in the report is and not recommended because of some of the things, I guess the issues involved. But I would have loved to see the copy of the report in its entirety, including its allegation reply, should be sent to the local government minister, so when the state government makes updates and changes, that from the lessons learned, all these things are taken into consideration. I also like to think that the report in its entirety, including the allegation and reply, under strict provision, should be available to other formal investigation as required. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Leibold. Any other speakers to this item? No? If not, I'll put that to the vote. All those in favour? I declare that carried unanimously. We might just take a short break for those of you who would like to depart at this time. So a short break for anyone who wishes to leave and perhaps not riveted to the normal everyday business of council. So I'll give you a moment. Thanks, everyone. Just for the purposes of the tape, note that Councillor Oak departed the meeting at 6:17. I now call on Councillor Rees to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to the planning portfolio.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. There are five reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio, and let's get on with council business, huh? The first is agenda item 6.1, West Melbourne Structure Plan. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? I'll take that as a no, and I will call on a councillor to move the motion. I'm happy to do that as the chair of plan. I look for councillor. Thank you, Councillor Leppard. This recommendation is looking for endorsement for the final West Melbourne Structure Plan. It is a document and a process which has gone through very, very extensive community consultations, and that is reflected in the fact that in a most recent survey of West Melbourne residents and stakeholders, feedback on the West Melbourne Structure Plan in its most recent draft, we had over 70% support in an area as fraught as planning. That is an absolutely extraordinary result. But it's a result that is not surprising given the very, very strong proposals that are contained inside this document that will make a very, very significant difference and a very, very significant improvement to West Melbourne. They include things like establishing Spencer Street as a local high street, focusing on streets as places for people, very much driving a place-based approach to the development of that area, including a focus around five places in the suburb around which communities form. There's some very innovative planning mechanisms involved, including new floor area ratios and built form controls, also support for mixed uses, showcasing climate resilience, and many, many other features. In this latest draft of the document, there are some small but not insignificant changes that have been made. They include a recommendation or some amendments that give additional actions to mitigate impacts on the Westgate Tunnel. In particular, that focuses on the Spencer Street being classified as a local road, not an arterial road. Some changes to the floor area ratio calculation to exclude basements. That will encourage the use of underground car parks when they are a feature of a building. Increased preferred maximum heights on Dudley and Oldley Street. The vision statement strengthened, and this is a really important point around West Melbourne really seeing itself as a part of this city, which is distinct, say, from Arden, which we're going to see quite a lot of development, or the central city, which is a very distinct and different area as well, and also those strengthened statements around the five key precincts inside West Melbourne. And then just finally, there's a change in here around affordable housing, and that applicants should deliver 6% affordable housing with an open book approach, if not feasible. So just in conclusion, I'd note that the next step in this process is that this draft structure plan will now be referred to the Minister, and then I look forward to the future Melbourne Committee meeting considering this proposal in 2 months when we will be considering planning scheme amendments which will give effect to this excellent bit of policy making.
Thank you, Chair. I agree wholeheartedly. This has been a very, very long process, but it's a process that's been very rewarding in many ways. I acknowledge previous Councillor Ong, who kicked this off from a political level in the previous term, but I particularly acknowledge the amazing work of the Urban Strategy Branch to pioneer new ways of consulting the community, pioneer new planning controls and land use controls that we've not pursued before as a planning authority, and to come up with a document that is of incredibly high quality that I'm very proud of that the City of Melbourne's been able to produce. And so I particularly thank the strategic planners for such an astonishing amount of work. Like Councillor Rees, I went to many community engagement processes and meetings and fora to deal with and capturing the vision that West Melbourne residents and business owners and the community at large has for West Melbourne. Over this process, I looked at what the current structure plan says, and believe it or not, there is a current structure plan. We never refer to it because as soon as you have a look at it, you realise just how quickly market forces have changed the nature of development in West Melbourne, and just how quickly the planning industry and best practice has moved on as well. What we've got here is something that is hundreds of times more complicated, not more complicated, but better grounded in solid research to arrive at this end result. I think comparing the two documents, the first, of course, is not to be criticised. It was of its time and was visionary of its time, but that was when West Melbourne was a suburb on the edge of the city rather than one that was undergoing the intense pressures that we see here. So I'm very excited about the new controls that we are pioneering. The place-based approach to dividing or acknowledging that West Melbourne is made up of lots of communities of interest, not just one homogenous group of residents or businesses, is important. But matching that with planning controls that allow a bit of consistency across the area so that all parties, developers, residents, objectors, council, decision makers, planners, understand what we're trying to achieve is really important. So the floor area ratio controls coupled with discretionary height limits is something that is not as easy to understand for the layperson as straightforward height limits, but it is testament to our team that the way they've tested those controls with the community has been overwhelmingly supported, and I acknowledge the submissions that have been made today. The way that they've been modelled with external architects and other planners should be commended, because that has supported the process throughout this structure plan. The floor area ratios are pretty much intact compared to where we proposed them quite a few months ago now, but that already was after a lot of research and work. And the land use controls, I think, are also pioneering and should be supported. We are looking at changing to a special use zone to arrest the conversion of all new development to 100% residential, which is what we're seeing. And whilst we welcome new residents to the City of Melbourne, we need to acknowledge that West Melbourne is an important mixed-use precinct that needs to be genuinely mixed-use. And so, again, can I just thoroughly commend officers for bringing to us such an astonishingly high-quality document. I look forward to seeing it implemented, including with new planning controls, in a couple of months' time.
Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Acting Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. I agree with my colleagues on this one. This is excellent. The West Melbourne Structure Plan is going to be, is already, even when it's not completely endorsed and raring to go, is already being used as a blueprint for other structure plans and even for places like Fisherman's Bend, which is absolutely fantastic. Obviously, the public realm improvements, converting what are really, really wide streets to more open space in West Melbourne will be excellent. As Councillor Leppert mentioned, the use of the special use zone, this is a really innovative way to guarantee minimum employment in a minimum employment floor area in West Melbourne. And I think, what we would have seen is essentially West Melbourne sort of go the route of turning into apartments completely. So this use of a special use zone really is going to guarantee us that true mixed use that gives the vibrancy to suburbs like this. Affordable housing target in there of 6%. So this is another step change in our 15% aspirational target, or up to 15% on our own land, but really going a step further in terms of delivering affordable housing. And, of course, the renewal of Spencer Street. It's nothing short of a shocking road as you sort of try and cross it as a pedestrian. It's, gridlocked a lot of the time. So to think of that as a local high street, I think the terminology is, I look forward to seeing that being delivered. It's going to be a huge task, but one that people in West Melbourne will absolutely welcome. And indeed, people in Melbourne as a whole to see Spencer Street evolve into one of our premier streets will be fantastic. So obviously to Kate, to Emma, to all the team, I know this has gone right across the whole organisation in terms of urban design, planning, traffic modelling, right across the whole organisation. It's absolutely quality work.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Councillor Francis Gilley.
Thank you. I think I just want to make a point of something that's coming up a bit later on. We're going to talk about Westgate Tunnel, and it's really interesting in terms of, you know, all the consultation that was done with the public is that one of their major concerns was, look, this could be great, but what do you fear could get in the way of this? And the Westgate Tunnel was the major concern that could get in the way and disrupt. So here we are calming an area, creating community, and you know, I know this is coming up later, but it's where, you know, we don't just have separate things. These things create a city that works together, and we're about to have a conversation about a road, a motorway effectively into this part of the city, and that was the community's concern, and I know it sits with many of us as the concern for the success of this plan, structure plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other speakers for or against the motion? All right, I might just conclude then by picking up a point made by Councillor Leppett around the and by the Acting Lord Mayor around the tremendous work that has been done by council officers and the quite extraordinary community consultation exercise that has gone on. It's not often as a councillor that you get a letter from a resident that genuinely warms your heart. The reality is that usually it takes you emotionally in the other direction. But this letter from Matthew or Matt in West Melbourne, I think, says everything about what the city is doing here. And he writes, you know, "Dear Council, I would like to enthusiastically commend the West Melbourne Structure Plan to the Council for adoption." He goes on and on talking about his connection with the area, and then he concludes by saying, "It has been a privilege to witness the excellent work of the planning team unfolding over the past couple of years. They have facilitated a very effective process of listening to the stakeholders of all kinds and continually improved their work in response. The result is something which has genuine community enthusiasm behind it, and I believe if properly implemented has the potential to make West Melbourne a great place to live and work and study in the future. Thank you so much." There you go. So on that note, I might put the recommendations to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, raise your hands. I'll declare that carried unanimously. Okay, moving on to agenda item 6.2, which is a ministerial referral, TPD 2012/32/A for 731-739 Flinders Street Docklands. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item?
I think we should.
We do have some presentations. I will take that as a pause on that, and I will now call on Chris Johnson, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
We might just do this in
Jamie.
We'll just reverse order.
Ah, okay.
If that's okay, apologies.
So you.
I'll speak and then Chris, if that's
right.
Okay.
Call on Jamie Govanlock to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to go off script for about 20 seconds here before I get into the presentation. Just in relation to some of the things that were said here tonight, I'd like to commend the council and the councils here tonight for tackling this issue head on. You haven't shirked at it. I work in a large organisation, a national company. This issue comes up from time to time. Often, groups of people, organisations don't tackle this issue such the way that you have, so I think you need to be commended on that. Thank you for indulging me. Back to reality. In relation to the planning item that we've got in front of us at the moment, you've all read the agenda item and so forth. I'd like to just go through some of the planning matters. I've got three issues. Effectively, DDO 10, when the planning permit here was granted initially, because we're going for a Section 72, we're amending the planning permit application. There's no further non-compliance with DDO 10 in respect of Amendment 262 when the original planning permit was granted. In fact, there's a decrease in floor area, a reduction in plot ratio in the sense because there's a basement that's placed within the development, which wasn't originally there. In terms of the land use, and I pick up on the point in relation to office use and so forth, the original scheme was primarily for an office development. This scheme is for residential and hotel. The reason for the lack of the office or the disappearing office effectively is there's been significant change in the precinct, particularly through development to the north in terms of Collins Quarter and so forth. It's been difficult to attract office tenants to this precinct. This is more of an entertainment, residential, 24-hour type precinct than it is an office precinct. We think a development such as this is better suited and geared towards that part of the market, and that's what we're finding out on a market analysis basis. In terms of built form, the building is slightly higher, 9.8 metres, than the original scheme. In the context of what's around the site, I suppose that's neither here nor there. That's a very minor increase. The building does pop in and out at various points along its journey at the upper levels, particularly in the southeast quadrant where there's another bay of hotel rooms. But importantly, and Chris will go through this in more detail, there's a lot more breathing space around the Seafarers Mission building. We have had discussions with that group. The last one was on the 17th of November. We do want to keep going with those discussions. In terms of the shadow's about the same. There is, I suppose, the positive story around that is that where there is the reduction, it's primarily over the adjacent proposed park to the east of the subject site, which we think is a positive. Ground plan activation, it's a lot better outcome than the original scheme. We've got a function centre, we've got restaurants, we've got cafes, and we've got a through link through the site, which we intend to manage and be open to the public, although it will be privately owned. So we would ask the councillors to support the officer's recommendation. We think it's been a terrific report. It's been a great journey, 18 months. And before I finish and get the final bell, I'd like to say thank you to the council officers involved who have been instrumental in guiding us through a difficult subjective design analysis phase dealing with representatives of the state government. So we've got some very clear and crystal guidance from your organisation. We were happy with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. So I will now call on Chris Johnson, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Could we have the video? Is it possible to start with the video? I've got three sort of takeaway messages. One's heritage, one's about context, one's about pedestrian movement. So when you look at the video up here, I suppose what we'd like you to take away from here is the fact that the sight lines through the Seafarers Mission is still retained. There's also further setbacks away from it. Our building sets back and allows the other building to breathe, the existing shed. We're going to remove the death, the cladding, the asbestos, and replace it with a similar material, obviously metal cladding. But the building above it, in terms of a context, we have apartments up above, we have hotel and then a function centre on ground floor. They all have their own distinctive fenestration, and I suppose that's what gives it the great quality of this project. Now, down on ground floor level, as we come in here, we're seeing we're coming around and we're coming onto Wurundjeri Way, which is a very difficult piece of... There is no rear to this building. All edges are active, and we've been able to do that through very conscious, compact design and also talking very heavily with DelWhip and City of Melbourne to get that to work. But you can see through here, this is one of the key desire lines in moving from Docklands through to South Wharf. You walk through that line there to go to Seafarers Bridge. And from that, could we now go to the PDFs? Is that possible, please? These, I suppose, if we could zoom in just a little bit. Traffic arrives from the right, from Sidley Street. It's a one-way scenario. Cars come in, they have to leave that way. We've addressed the potential conflict with traffic calming through a lot of surface rumble strips and things like that. So people, that desire line from the north, from Collins Square, will be able to move through to Seafarers Bridge. We've also deactivated the edges, as I said, and the vehicle queuing for the function centre, which is to the west end, occurs in the basement. That would have been a concern, but we've managed to get the queuing in the basement. So that I suppose, alleviates the ground floor for the transfer of people. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Chris. I now call on Neil Edwards to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Neil.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nigel Porteous. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Mission to Seafarers. We simply request the Council to give the Mission to Seafarers an opportunity to properly examine the new amendment to the plans that we previously were shown. As the letter to the Council has stipulated, we had a meeting with Asset One River Lee in November, and that was a very constructive meeting. But when we asked if we could have a copy of the video that you've just seen, we were advised that it wasn't available to us at that time, and also that the final amendments to the plans were also not available to us at that stage because there was apparently more work to be done to it. The end result of that is the first that we knew that this proposal was going to Council was on Sunday evening, and the first time we had the opportunity to see the completed amendments to the plans was from the Council website on Monday. So we are still very, very happy to discuss with Asset One and River Lee all the aspects of the plan. We have had a very cordial relationship with them, but we have to have the finalised plans or the amendments to the plans approved by our board before we can sign off our acceptance of them as far as the Mission to Seafarers is concerned. So I simply respectfully request the Council to grant an adjournment of this proposed vote today until the Mission is able to properly look at the plans and decide with our board if we want to proceed with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Nigel?
Sorry.
There's a question for you, Nigel.
Sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you for the submission. Given that the Minister is the ultimate...
Can you speak up a bit? I'm a little bit deaf, sorry.
Sure, no worries. Given that the Minister for Planning is the ultimate decision maker, have you put the question for a deferral and an opportunity to discuss the plans to the allocated planner from the department? Because we will not be in a position to defer anything tonight. We are only a recommending referral authority. These questions will need to be put to the Minister's delegate.
No, well, we haven't, because we haven't seen the final amendments to the plans. We don't know what the planning is.
We may be able to assist you in putting you in touch with the delegate, I'm not sure, but just wanted to acknowledge that we're not the decision maker, we're only a recommending referral authority, but we can touch on that again in the debate. But thank you.
Nigel, I'd also make the observation that, I mean, there wouldn't be a councillor here who doesn't commend the tremendous work that's done by the Seafarers Mission. There wouldn't be a councillor here who doesn't commend the tremendous work that's done by the Seafarers Mission. We also, as a council, pride ourselves on the extent we go to around community consultation, around new development proposals. I mean, ultimately, it is the obligation of citizens or residents or affected parties to notify us when they have concerns about things. As I said, notwithstanding that, we do go to great lengths. Jane Birmingham, I might just check with you. Was there anything you want to make as way of observation around the community consultation process around this particular development proposal?
Councillor, this application, as Councillor Leppett has correctly pointed out, is being determined by the Planning Minister, and Council is simply providing commentary to the Minister. This application is actually exempt from public notification and the appeal processes that many planning applications are subject to. Nevertheless, I understand that River Lee, the applicant, has been having dialogue with the Mission to Seafarers organisation, and will continue to do so, and the opportunity is not lost to put some comments to the Minister's department because the Minister has not yet made a decision on this application to date.
All right. Well, in light of that, I'm certainly happy to proceed with the recommendations which are up on the screen for agenda item 6.2, and I would now call on all those in favour of the motion to raise your hands. Sorry. I'll now put the motion that's on the screen. I'll look for a councillor to second it. I'll move it. Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Are there any councillors who want to speak to the motion? I'll speak to it as the person moving it. this application, I think, first came before council in 2012, so it's been in the system for over 5 years now. It has been a long and collaborative journey, and I think there's been over 10 meetings just on the latest iteration of the development proposal. I think on balance there's actually a lot to like about what has been presented to us here. In particular, I like the fact that it's going to activate Sidley Street and that Seafarers Rest Park, which the City of Melbourne is very much behind. You know, if you're looking at a map of Melbourne and you sort of and you'd never been to this city before and you wanted to know where the action was, you would naturally gravitate to that riverside location. And I think it's a sort of an unloved corner of the of our river frontage, and so I think this development in particular will go a long way to activating that and making it just another vibrant piece of the city. The intention to build the 4 to 5 star hotel I think will be great for the city and great for the city economy. The fact that it retains the goods shed as well, I think that's been quite cleverly done, and the fact that this is a building which has no services back to it and therefore is activated on all fronts, I think is very, very clever and is a response to the City of Melbourne really pushing for activation on all sides. I would note that the final round of modifications, which have changed the height and massing of the building such that there will now be no overshadowing of the south bank of the river, is a very positive thing as well. So I'll conclude on that note and call on Councillor Lippitt to make some comments.
Thank you, Chair. I would hope that we're not merely congratulating the applicant for retaining the shed, but as it's on the Heritage Register and there's an existing permit, I would like to say that the improvement from the current existing incorporated document or permit, I forget how it's incorporated, is generally very, very good. It's a very sensitive site. You've got the Mission for Seafarers right next door, and of course the fundamental question here with this application is the extent to which the heritage shed is changed. But of course there is an existing permit which already changes the shed fundamentally. And so we're not just considering is the proposal before us, or before the Minister, a good one for the city, but also how does it improve or not from what's currently approved for the site. I think it's a very good improvement. I think that the care into the detail of the design has been thought through very carefully. But what I would like to say is that the process is only been successful because of the negotiation between our officers and the department's officers together with the applicant. If this had gone purely through a statutory process of an application and a response, we wouldn't necessarily have come to a good outcome. I think that the originally applied for plans did not adequately separate the new built form from the heritage sheds and distinguish the new architecture from what's currently there. The new building obviously does dominate and overwhelm the place, and so what we should be asking for and what our officers have done an astonishingly good job in negotiating is a separation of those two built forms and a separation of architecture that is quite good. The building envelope of what's being proposed here is generally the same as what was previously proposed. I think that the relationship with the Mission for Seafarers is actually a marked improvement. On most of the setback tests, there's an improvement. On a couple, there aren't, but overall, I think the improvement is definitely there to see. I just make the final point to the Mission for Seafarers, again, that we're not the decision maker. You can certainly make your case to the Minister's delegate in the department, but the reason we're considering this matter in this way, in this place, is because we automatically call all these matters in. We try to get some sort of public ventilation over what's proposed. Without that, that wouldn't happen because there are no third-party notice, advertisement and objection rights for applications like this. So this is the opportunity, but we are very limited in what we can do to defer things, to change things. We do have an MOU with the Minister for Planning's department, and so this is generally as far as we can go from a procedural level. But again, we have done a remarkable job, our officers, our planners, in working with the applicant to continually improve what's put before us, and I'm happy to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Are there any other councillors who wish to speak against or for?
I'd just like to comment that it seems to me to be the difficulty we have here listening to Mr. Porteous is a breakdown in communication between the developer and the mission, and clarity required around these quite complex relationships between planning authorities or responsible authorities. So I would hope that the City of Melbourne steps right up and continues to feed in to the Mission to Seafarers the expertise that we have. The mission is a very, very important element in our city, both from the heritage point of view, but also the social services it provides.
Councillor Francis Gilley.
On your drawings, just to one of the drawings, it talks about pontoons to future detail by others. I spent 4 hours on the Yarra waterways on Friday with officers just driving around all the waterways. And what's really interesting is the river comes alive when those pontoons are real, and a real opportunity for boats to pull up or taxis to pull up or boats to unload. And actually you've got one of the few that the crane that's actually being retained is actually, as you go up and down the Yarra or into the docks, is one of the few really old remaining relics right on the water in the city that reminds you this once was a working port. So you've got a really lovely bit of heritage which you protected. But if you make, you know, so the bit that's a little bit of detail, which, you know, may or may not get filled in, and I don't know how, I would really, you know, really encourage you to talk with those people, you know, Melbourne City Council and others, that could help make that become a living part of the river and not something that's just there and dies, because it's a great opportunity. And it's next to a piece. One of my first jobs when I got here actually was going out on one of the little boats from the Seafarers Mission to go and visit some people that were effectively slaves on a boat that weren't allowed off into the city, and they were taking them food. So it was really active. I went in a little boat. You know, we should try and keep that bit of river alive, and you as the developers could do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Councillor Pinder Mortimer.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. Just from my perspective, I think it's great to see a 4.5-star hotel, new entrant to the market. It's superb. Also the function space. There's a dearth of function space in the city, and so close to the convention centre. Great move. Brilliant. So well done.
Just two quick replies from me as the mover. Councillor Francis Gilley, you'll be delighted to know that the crane will have an even more prominent role on the Melbourne waterfront under this development, and where it'll be moved eastwards, so it'll be sort of the gateway, if you like, to the building. And not only that, it will be painted marine orange, which is its original heritage colour, which will no doubt evoke the working days of old for that good shed. In relation to Councillor Watt's question about the Seafarers Mission, I also share your feelings that the Seafarers Mission should be consulted, and so as part of the correspondence in our response to the Minister referral, we also encourage the Minister to continue to consult with them before a final decision is made.
If there are no other people who wish to speak to this motion, I will therefore put it to the vote. All those in favour, please indicate. You'll raise your hands. Thank you. I declare that carried unanimously. And we'll now move on to agenda item 6.5, Planning Scheme Amendment C320 for 154 to 160 Leicester Street. I'm having an administrative shocker tonight. We're actually going to go to the next item on the agenda, which is 6.4, which is a ministerial referral, TPM 2017. 6.3. All right, my God. Ministerial referral, TPM 2016-27557 to 591, Swanston Street, Carlton. That's 6.3 for those who didn't hear. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? Okay, I think that would be a good idea, and I call on Evan Council, Practice Leader, Land Use and Development, to make a brief presentation.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor, councillors and members of the public. This is a ministerial referral of a planning application for a 22-storey mixed-use building. Predominant use is for student accommodation. There is 753 units proposed as part of this proposal, and we're up located on the northern section of the city on the eastern side of Swanston Street in the northeastern corner of what's known as the old Carlton United Brewery site. Important to note that there has been some substantial development and approvals on the southern end of this site, but the northern end of the site, as you can see from the image on the screen, remains largely undeveloped. The area is within the comprehensive development zone and is covered by an approved comprehensive development plan, which specifies what type of development should happen in this location. The Minister for Planning is the responsible authority. Apologies. Can I ask that the 3D dam please be activated so that councils can get some context on the site? The Minister for Planning is the responsible authority for determining this application. It's been informally referred to council for comment. It does happen to be that the applicant has lodged a failure appeal against the minister for his failure to determine this application within the statutory timeframes. The minister's position on this proposal is also already formally known, and he does not support the proposal, and that's his position when he does present to VCAT in the future. The management report presented to councillors tonight is to consider and put into the public realm council's formal position. Council has been joined as a party to the proceeding, and the report recommends not supporting the proposal. The image on the screen depicts the application. The image on the left is a complete render of the proposal pre-VCAT. During the VCAT process, the applicant has formally amended the plans, and part of that formal amendment, although you may not be able to tell by what's on the screen, on the right-hand side, the podium or street wall structure has been reduced by approximately one level, and the overall height of the building has been increased by one to two levels. What's on the screen now is the image of the comprehensive development plan. The site in question is the site where I'm pointing now. The comprehensive development plan indicates a building height of approximately 11 storeys. Although there has been approvals in the precinct that are significantly above the heights indicated in the plan, here we're looking at a building that's double the height specified in the plan, and although there is the ability to exercise some discretion, we believe that in this instance the discretion exceeds what is appropriate for the site. The image here shows the building as it fronts Swanston Street. You can see there's a podium element or a street wall element, then a minor setback. There are new laneways which run along the southern edge of the site through the centre of the Carlton United Brewery precinct, as well as a new laneway, which runs across the rear of the site within the precinct. There's ground level activation along all those frontages there. As you can see from the ground floor plan on the screen, the top of the screen is the Swanston Street frontage, which includes in dark purple retail, in light yellow and orange entry and circulation spaces, and in the light grey or purple colour that is plant and service areas for the proposal. Up at level one are communal facilities for the students, and on the screen right now is a typical floor plate layout containing student accommodation units. Any questions?
I don't think there are, Evan. Thank you very much for that. And then there should be now a motion coming up on the screen, and I am happy to move that motion, and I call for a councillor to second the motion. Thank you, Councillor Leppert. So, look, as Evan has pointed out, this is a ministerial referral. The Minister, Richard Wynne, has already opposed it, and the reasons for that are pretty obvious. It's a building that is too high, and it has just too much mass for that site and for that part of the city. I would say that the City of Melbourne has been very generous in its discussions with Scape, the developer, around height and the street wall, and yet Scape has not seemed to be wanting to be willing to negotiate. I should point out that Scape has a growing presence in Melbourne. They are a major investor and developer, having come here from the UK, and certainly I, as a councillor, very much welcome their investment and the commitment to this city. But I've also got to say that this proposal flies in the face of the planning controls for this area and for our vision for this part of the city. It is just too excessively ambitious in terms of height and mass, and they have really failed to relinquish any yield or, for that matter, to negotiate with us in good faith. So they have gone and lodged an appeal based on the Minister's failure to reach a decision within 60 days. That was done notwithstanding the fact that they were in discussions with the Minister at the time, and you know, any reasonable observer would say that they were pushing the envelope as well. So the Minister has made his position clear. This motion, I think, makes the City of Melbourne's position clear, and you know, we will see what happens next. Councillor Leppert.
Thank you, Chair. As you know, I'm very reluctant to ever disagree with the Planning Minister, so I'm very happy that we're backing him in this case. I agree that the proposal is an overdevelopment of the site. There's a long history with frustrations from lots of different places about the comprehensive development plan for this mega block along Swanston Street and south of Queensbury. There have been many applications over the time, as the presenter has suggested to us, that far exceed the discretionary controls that are suggested in the plan. And I've had another read through bits of the comprehensive development plan again today to remind myself that, yes, you really can drive a truck through many of its provisions. I think that's really lamentable, because if you've incorporated into the scheme a plan for a particular block, you've got the opportunity to say, as government, exactly what is appropriate for the site. But when the controls are so loosely drafted and speculative sale of land occurs accordingly, the price of that land is maxed out, and the onus on the developer who purchases the site to extract maximum value out of the site means that we're inflating the value of that site out of control, really. And what we're talking about here is much-needed student accommodation in the City of Melbourne, which, first and foremost, should be affordable, but it is in a place that is part of a decade-long problem with the way that the scheme's been drafted in this place, and so I lament that the controls are so poorly drafted. But they are the controls, and we need to decide whether or not the application conforms with the development plan. I certainly don't think it does. Merely on height alone, it certainly doesn't. Government has a track record of considering height well above what is allowed at a discretionary level, but if we do that, it should be of very, very high quality design. And as much as I welcome Scape's commitment to building in the city, I don't think this cuts it and doesn't get anywhere near. So I wish the Minister well at the tribunal.
Thank you, Councillor. Are there any other speakers for or against this motion? In that case, I will now put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, raise your hands. I declare that carried unanimously.
The next planning item is agenda item 6.4. Thank you, Councillor. Which is another ministerial referral, TPM 2017-5. It's for 512 to 542 and 544 Spencer Street, West Melbourne. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item?
Yes, that would be great.
Okay, in that case, I will call on Officer Jane Birmingham, Practice Leader, Land Use and Development, to make a brief presentation. Thank you, Jane.
Okay, councillors, this is, as Councillor Rees said, a ministerial referral for a planning application in Spencer Street. The site has two other frontages to Roden Street and Stanley Street. And that's the site there at the moment. It's got the old 1930s warehouse on it that actually has no heritage grading. Can we run the 3D dam, please? So this site is in a mixed-use zone. It's subject to the current DDO 29, which has a preferred height of 4 storeys. And this site is also covered by the West Melbourne Structure Plan that Council's been considering tonight as well. This is proposed to be in the Spencer Street precinct, which has a preferred height of 6 levels and a preferred floor area ratio of 4 to 1. What is proposed? And I think I can flick straight off it. Yep. Okay. It's a 9-storey proposal, which would have an overall height of 31.4 metres. It's a mixed-use development, so at ground level there's actually an Aldi supermarket proposed, and where's the pointer thingy? No, what have I done? Sorry. Okay, there's an Aldi supermarket proposed at ground floor with the loading bay off Stanley Street. There's 4 retail tenancies as well. In total there's 274 car spaces in 3 basement levels. And then above that, there are a total of 197 apartments. There's essentially a 5-storey podium, and the 2 higher components are set back in the order of 5 metres above level 6. Officers are not recommending support for this application. It's been referred to us from the department, and officers are proposing at this point that we object, because it's at a height of 9 levels in a preferred 4-storey area. Any questions from councillors?
I think there is.
Thank you, Officer Birmingham. thanks, Jane. Can I ask, there's been a desire to adhere to the better apartment design standards, and the plans for many of the apartments have resulted in effectively hallways in the bedrooms in order to ensure that the light is still there where the bedroom proper is. Is this an example of a potential bad outcome of the application of the Better Apartment Design Standards, or in your opinion, are there other reasons why we've got the particular layouts that we see in these plans?
This application, my understanding is it actually predates the introduction of the Better Apartment Standards. We would say that the outcome that we're seeing on the screen there is a product probably of an overdevelopment. There's some concern about the separation between buildings. Sometimes it's as close as 4 metres, and there's also a very limited separation to the Allura apartment building as well, to the northeast. So, yeah, we're in addition to other concerns, we also have concerns about the internal amenity of these apartments. Thank you.
Any other questions for Jane? Okay, thank you very much for that, Jane. If we could just get the motion up on the screen, and I am happy to move that motion, and I call upon Councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppert. Look, I think it's been explained well by Jane Birmingham. This development does not meet with the community or council expectations for this part of the city. As was mentioned, the current height controls for this part of the city in West Melbourne are 6 storeys. This building before us is at 9 storeys. the new West Melbourne Structure Plan, which we discussed earlier this evening, calls for a floor area ratio of 4-1 in this part of West Melbourne. This proposal comes in at 7-1. So, as I said, this is just not the outcome that the community and the council are looking for in this part of the city, and therefore I support the motion as put before us. Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair. I agree again, and thank officers for their assessment. The mass and the height of the building is well above what the discretionary controls allow, and again, like the previous item, I think that we have a track record of looking seriously at a proposal that goes well outside the preferred built envelope if it's of very high quality. I'm very concerned about the measly setbacks to some of the neighbouring buildings on this site, and it hasn't been cited as one of the major reasons for opposition here, but the internal layout of the apartments is, on first glance at least, I'm no architect, problematic, and a desire to max out the development potential of the site has resulted in inefficiently designed apartments, I would suggest. And so although the Minister's the decision maker again rather than us, I think that we should take a firm line on this. The last point I just want to make is that whilst we have adopted the structure plan today and it should be a consideration in our thinking, we also have to ask the question, should this be refused even not taking the new structure plan into consideration, because it isn't a seriously entertained document. We haven't exhibited any of the controls that result from it, and so an over-reliance on what we're about to propose in the structure plan shouldn't be a basis for refusing it. But I think the answer is definitely yes, based on the current controls, even putting aside the structure plan. It's not of high enough quality to warrant such a for going so far outside the preferred built envelope. So I'm happy to reject or recommend to the Minister that he reject the proposal.
Acting Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with Councillor Leppett. You know, in some ways, sort of the mixed use and, you know, what would be considered, it's probably borderline, but medium density development, and trying to get, you know, sort of more accommodation options or into West Melbourne. That side of it is good, but it's just simply an overdevelopment of the site. It's too tall, and the ratio is too high. As Councillor Leppett has identified, the setbacks and the separation between the buildings and the quality of the design. So I'm not saying it's borderline in terms of, you know, if the design quality was a lot higher that they might get away with such an overdevelopment, but the mixed-use side of it is a step in the right direction. But happy to send a message to the Minister that this is not the sort of development that we want to see in West Melbourne.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Are there any other speakers for or against the motion? I'll just quickly reinforce a point made during the debate around what we're relying on in this recommendation, and we're very much relying on current controls around six stories for this part of Spencer Street, not on the new West Melbourne structure plan, which is yet to be activated. And so, yeah, it's very much reliant on current controls. Okay, I'll now put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, raise your hands. I declare that motion carried unanimously. The next agenda item, 6.5, concerns 154 to 160 Leicester Street, Carlton, former Corkman Irish Pub. I should declare any direct interest on this matter due to my employment at the University of Melbourne, the fact that there are two of our students who are currently involved in proceedings against the developer, or the owner, I should say, and also that the University of Melbourne are a landholder on both sides of this development. So I'll hand over to the Deputy Chair of Planning.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. We'll just pause for one moment. Okay, as Councillor Rees said, this item is Agenda Item 6.5, Planning Scheme Amendment C320, the Corkman Pub. Would any councillor like a presentation on this item or have any questions? No? Fantastic. I'm just going to double check, unless one of my colleagues wants to tell me that it's not the case, that we don't have any submitters. We don't. Thank you, Councillor Francis Gilley. I'm going to go straight to moving the motion, which is the recommendation for management, and I thank the Acting Lord Mayor for seconding it. As is set out in the report, but for the benefit of everyone here, the Minister, of course, applied interim heritage control, interim design and development overlay controls for this site to require the reconstruction of a facsimile of the hub, and those controls are going to expire. In December, we asked the Minister for permission to prepare and exhibit a planning scheme amendment, and we've now come through in February after, I think, quite a very quick but very thorough research and policy development stage to propose a planning scheme amendment. That process included external advice on what would be possible on the site, and I thank TRACT for that report, and also quite comprehensive heritage advice as to what is reasonable to ask and to require the reconstruction of through a design and development overlay. This amendment doesn't touch the heritage overlay. It does something very unusual, but we're trying to draft it in such a way that we have got the best possible chance of an outcome. And that outcome is a requirement to reconstruct as much of the Corkman, which has been demolished illegally, as is possible, using as much of the original fabric as is possible, and requiring the use of expert heritage professionals throughout the process as much as possible. We're putting it back into the City North Design and Development Overlay that Councillor's Planning Authority put in place a few years ago, and so we're putting all these controls back in the one place, but we do need to get on with it because the Minister's given us the task of being the Planning Authority here. We'll take on the cost, thank you, Planning Minister, but that's okay. I think we should take the lead here and make sure that regardless of who the owner is, regardless of legal proceedings that are currently underway, that we're not ending up with a poor planning outcome on this very important site, diagonally opposite a heritage park and the site of the former Corkman, which should reflect the Corkman in future as well. Acting Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Councillor Leppett. I won't cover off on the detail of the amendment. I think you always do that very well. But needless to say that we're at a point here, and obviously there are proceedings afoot, so we'll be a little bit careful in what we'll say here. But, let's not be sort of shy in saying that this is a mess that's trying to be cleaned up because Cowboy Developers knocked over a building which actually had protection. And that's a serious shame that we're in that position. I think our officers have done an excellent job in coming to what would be a reasonable position. We've still got to go through an exhibition process, so there's still a way to go on this, but we shouldn't forget that we're in this position because someone decided that the rules didn't apply to them and they would simply knock over a building. I'm pleased to say that that is not the culture in the development community in Melbourne, and I hope we never see anything like this again.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Any other contributors to this debate? No, I won't close debate because I think the comment about detail is probably code for I'm talking too much already, and I will put the motion. All those in favour? That's unanimous, thank you. Let's invite Councillor Rees back in, and while we do that, I will hand over to Councillor Francis Gilley to chair the transport part of tonight's agenda.
There is one report from management for consideration under the transport portfolio, agenda item 6.6, Victorian Government Assessment of Westgate Tunnel Project Environmental Effects. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? So I now call on Bernard Robin, who requested the opportunity to address the committee on relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Bernard.
Dear Lord Mayor and councillors, my contribution to the fight against the Westgate Tunnel project hinges on two specific points. Firstly, complaining can only be seen as a negative attitude that is all too easy to dismiss. By contrast, offering a better solution reverses the roles. the grumpy plaintiff becomes a positive campaigner, making Transurban look like the one who didn't get it right from scratch. In response to the proposal I emailed to the council in July 2017, you replied to me, Aaron, in bold and underlined letters. We believe that your strategic and lateral thinking is exactly the kind of input major projects like this need. Moving swans and dogs out of the agglomeration is not a new idea. It solves more than just one problem and makes the Westgate Tunnel completely obsolete. We all know this is a bad project. We all know it'll pave the way to more bad projects, so we have to do what it takes to stop it. So far, Rosa McKenna from the Spotswood South Kingfield Community Action Group is the only person who's got the guts to take the Andrews government to the Supreme Court on her own. If the council is concerned about the financial consequences of possibly being dismissed, then at least you should support community groups and people like Rosa. However, it now is a matter of extreme urgency. Construction is about to start almost as we speak. And even if we manage to obtain a judicial review, it will only buy us a bit of time, but ultimately the project will happen. Which brings up my second point. We all know that the court case against it didn't stop the East-West Link, the East-West Link project, but the shift of power at the previous state election did. Last November, when I asked one of you guys what was the real way to stop the tunnel, the reply I got was, I guess it is getting Daniel Andrews out of office. What I'm saying is, it was a political matter from start, and politics only would stop it. In fact, I believe the next state elections are probably our best chance to stop this project, and hopefully much sooner than next November. Whatever your allegiance to the Victorian government, now is the time to jump in the arena and take a stand. And I'm happy to borrow some lines from Russell Crowe and say, it's time to rise and rise until lambs become lions.
Thank you, Bernard. Your time is up.
The other line I'd like you, Aaron, to borrow from Russell Crowe is, I will win the crowd and I will give them something they've never seen before.
Bernard, sorry, you've had your 3 minutes. Your time is up.
What? The Melbourne City Council is the highest authority that opposes the tunnel. If you win the crowd, City of Melbourne will have as much power as the government, or even more.
Bernard.
Bernard, I love that. Bernard. I love that movie, but there's a three-minute allocation so that everyone can get it.
I've got to be
your three-minute allocation is up. The chair's just indicating that your three-minute allocation is...
I cannot hear you, sorry.
So, Bernard, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, great. There's only 3 minutes and you're well over your time. I've asked a few times if you'd
time
stop.
Before.
No, I can
do it in 2.5 minutes. I'm done anyway. Well, you know the idea behind the whole thing, okay? So if the City of Melbourne cannot stop this, no one can.
Okay. Thank you, Bernard.
And Aaron, you've got children. If you do it for Melbourne, at least do it. If you don't do it for Melbourne, do it for your kid.
Okay. So. We've got it, Bernard. Thank you. I know you've been campaigning for a long time on this. I'm grateful for your contribution, but right now we have to finish. Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks.
I couldn't hear what you said. But look, I think you missed the point because...
Bernard, sorry, that the allocation of time is finished, so we need to now begin the debate on the item. Thank you.
There's another speaker.
Okay.
So I now call upon Jerry McLaughlin to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I'm Jerry McLaughlin, Secretary of Inner Melbourne Planning Alliance. We're on the record as not supporting the Westgate Tunnel, and I'm also here to say that we believe collectively that this project fails in all that it proposes to its objectives and fails in the community's mandate. It also fails in meeting the expectations the community were led to have in the previous government's elections. In summary, IMPA believes that the West Gate Tunnel has no community mandate and is in complete conflict with the promises of the current government's election promises. We hold that the project is a significant threat to the entire city and will consign Victoria to a retrograde car and freight road-based future model, which is unsustainable and in direct conflict with stated climate change goals and, in fact, City of Melbourne's resilience goals. We're deeply disappointed that the fast-tracked EES and EPA works permit IAC hearing process and the cynical exercise in bundling the process in such a way that removes the opportunities for a merits review of this deeply flawed project. We are very concerned with the disrespectful treatment of the formal parliamentary planning approval process and the recent public statements by Transurban that they, in fact, don't believe they need Parliament's approval at all, which is a whole new territory. We understand that the City of Melbourne has had in recent years, upheld a gentleman's agreement, if you like, to abide by state government's decision once they've handed down in the interests of a workable state and city relationship. However, we believe that the times have come to question this arrangement that has been so sorely put to the test in this instance. Quite apart from the more recent examples of the Apple building in Fed Square, which I believe is going to be discussed later, this is yet another case. We put to you, this is the time that arrangement has, that the city needs to defend their leadership position on this subject. And has the leadership position it took in the hearings, and we'd argue for a rational, sustainable transport model consistent with the world's best practice in good planning and consistent with your own policies of the last 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerry. Could you please put up the new motion? Thank you. I call on the councillor to second the motion. Councillor Louis, I'd like to speak to the motion. So, thank you, Gerry. I agree. Can I start by just thanking the officers for the work they've done on this? The management report has, as you pointed out, Gerry, recognised that work has started, and we need to have a working relationship with the state. And as such, has put 10 recommendations forward for if this poor piece of public policy and transport policy goes ahead, which it is going ahead at the moment, that we actually work with the council to get the best possible outcomes that we can for all areas that are impacted by the city by this road. And so the new proposal includes those 10 elements of improvement that we would want to see from the state. But it also starts with two earlier comments, and if we can go to the top, that is the top, yes, thank you, sorry. And the first is that we are just saying that this is poor policy, and we, if you see there, it's contrary to the long-established state and city policy and practice. It has significant negative effects and therefore is not supported. I mean, I think we really want to start by saying that, you know, as we heard before, with West Melbourne, as we've heard with all of our submissions during the review, we're in a situation where we absolutely believe this is not a good outcome for the city, and we want to withhold that position. We also, however, in point two, acknowledge that the Victorian government's willingness to commit to mitigate some of the negative effects of the project as raised in the environmental effects statement. I want to say at the moment that we have heard that they had that commitment, but that is not there. So we are saying, first of all, don't go ahead, and secondly, if you do go ahead, we really want you to, we want to see the action of that mitigation. And then the third point, the point three includes all the recommendations from officers. There is one addition to those 10 points. If we go to the very last point, which we are asking for a commitment to work with the council to achieve the best possible outcomes in line with the minister's assessment, and for the funding a full-time City of Melbourne team to service the project through to its completion, in line with Metro Tunnel support team and funding. We have had a different kind of bit of policy because obviously building a train line in terms of we perceived as great public policy and transport policy. However, we have been resourced to be able to work with the government to get the best outcomes over the whole period of the project and going right the way through to the end of the project. If this was to go ahead or is to continue to go ahead, it is really important that we as a city council are resourced to work as much as we possibly can to get the best outcomes for all for the city. And so that's an addition to the officers. 10 points. That's all. Doug?
Thank you, Councillor Francis Gill. And I also note the very comprehensive recommendation that is put forward. A lot of work was put into that. And we spoke about the West Melbourne Structure Plan. And I think, you know, the fact that it was the most important. While I was there during the community consultation, it was, you know, the most a debated issue that, you know, people were talking about. And I think the fact that, you know, we ripped up $1.1 billion of taxpayer money to put this on, you know, to build this is just atrocious. And I think, you know, whatever we can do, and hopefully that we can work with the state government on something like this, because, like you said, for West Melbourne and for...